Ever wondered what powers the world of your favorite superheroes? Dive into Understanding Superhero Comic Books, the definitive guide that unravels the mystery. It plunges into the captivating world of spandex, superpowers, and the masterminds who conceive them. Trace the origins and evolution of superhero comics, fueled by influences from Bela Lugosi's enigmatic charm, Errol Flynn's daring exploits, and the early mesmerizing magicians. Witness Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, and more as they navigate societal shifts, reflecting our world within their epic tales. Buy Alex Grand's Understanding Superhero Comic Books, available now.
Well, welcome back to the Comic Book Historians Podcast. I am your hoary host, Alex Grand. Today, I'm happy to present another David Armstrong interview, this one with John Romita Sr. As said before, David Armstrong is a Golden Age historian, and he was able to capture these amazing Golden and Silver Age interviews back in the area of 1997 to 2005. Thankfully, a lot of wonderful information and conversation was captured, and I was naturally proud to digitize and edit them for podcast format here on Comic Book Historians. In this case with John Romita, he goes through a career retrospective with the man. He goes into his initial partnership with Les Zacharin and then meeting Stan Lee at Timely Comics, working on science fiction, Famous Funnies. He also goes into his meeting Joe Manili and getting inking advice, working at DC Comics on romance titles, and of course, returning to Marvel in the Silver Age and working alongside Stan Lee with observations about Martin Goodman, Jack Kirby, and the rest. Let's get started as David takes it away.
When did you start drawing?
Well, like a lot of kids, I started drawing about 5 years old, maybe earlier, but about five. I used to get a lot of mileage out of doing drawings.
Did you do stuff in high school or junior high school?
Oh, yeah. Went through the whole, starting from elementary school, fourth and fifth grade, I decorated the halls every holiday, Valentine's Day, Lincoln's birthday, Washington's birthday, all the holiday, 4th of July. I did Civil War generals, everything. I decorated all the backgrounds on plays.
And so did you know that's what you wanted to do for a living?
I assumed I was going to be an artist. I didn't have a lot of confidence, but I really never stopped. Amazing.
And where'd you get your first paid professional job?
That's interesting. I got out of high school. I graduated on my 17th birthday. I was lucky that way. They had an advanced class. The school recommended me to a doctor on 2nd Avenue. It was called Manhattan General at the time. It's another name for the hospital now. This doctor was instituting a new process. He was an anesthesiologist, but he was a multimillionaire anesthesiologist. And he was instituting this new process from ambulance to operation that would be coordinated by this process. He called it pneumatology. It means something else now. But I was 17 years old, and he told me, can you do an exhibit? He showed me a long corridor in this second floor of this hospital. I want an exhibit down these corridor walls and a turn at the door. And he said, could you design and illustrate it and execute it? And I must have been crazy. I said, yes. I had no professional experience. I designed it. I used medical books to do cross sections of hearts, lungs. I did everything in that exhibit. I purchased all the materials after I designed it in sketch form and he okayed it. Then I had to execute it on 4x8 cardboard, thick board, quarter inch thick, mounted on wooden frames. I went to hardware stores and art supply stores in Union Square and ordered all the stuff, billed it to him, and I put it together on the floor of that office, every single frame, 4x8, and I scaled up every one of my thumbnail drawings onto that board. I drew them, I painted them, I photostatted some things, photographs. I did 6 months of He paid me $60 a week, which was more than my father was making at the time to raise five kids. 60 bucks a week. And I was really trying to drag it out. And I still got it done in 6 months because I was figuring the longer I'd take, the longer he's going to pay me. Until he finally got wise to me. This guy was a very impressive illustrated version of the perfect doctor from a movie. Had a white goatee and white hair and had a castle on the Hudson. And he had 12 children. It was almost a Hollywood setup. I think the carpenters helped me to hang it. That was the one thing I needed help for. They put up the hooks and I put wire and hung them as picture frames. 6 months, and I did that whole thing. I thought it was beautiful until I saw pictures of it about 10 years later, and then I threw them out. I hated it. It was so bad.
Is it still up?
No, no. It only stayed up for about 2 months. He had a cocktail party and people coming constantly, and I stayed for a while as a guide at $60 a week, and then I was on my own.
Just keep any of the pictures?
No, just that book, that photo book, and it was so bad when I looked at it. I was so embarrassed by it, I never showed it to anybody anymore. It was comprehensive. It told the story, but I was not pleased with all the drawings. I mean, I was really just a rank amateur.
And so how did you get to do comic books?
My second job, I was an office boy messenger at Litho House called Forbes Litho. They were one of the litho houses in the city during the late 40s that were competing for Coca-Cola assignments. They used to do the festoons that appeared in the ice cream parlors behind the counter, showing a beautiful girl drinking a bottle of Coke and Santa Claus at Christmas and Coke bottles on both ends. I did so many Coke bottles in 2.5 years that I could do them in my sleep. And I was working on some of the work of the best artists in the business. And it was a wonderful 2.5 years until I met somebody I graduated school with who wanted me to ghost a comic book story for them. His name was Lester Zacharin. I'd just been speaking to him after a 40-year hiatus. He was an inker, couldn't get any work. So he figured if he told him he could pencil, he'd get work. And Stan Lee gave him work. But he needed a guy to ghost it because he was not fast enough to do the pencils himself. So I penciled for him as a ghost. He inked it and turned it in as his own work. It was very interesting.
And how long did that work?
Maybe 2 years. I think I started in September of 49. All through 50, I believe, we worked together. And Stan Lee gave us maybe 1 7- or 8-page story a month or something like that. It was keeping us in groceries. I made more money on that first pencil assignment than I did in a month. I was making $21 a week at the Litho House after taxes. So when I got my first check for $270, I treated everybody in the family to a midsummer Christmas. It was crazy.
When did you get discovered? When did they find out that you weren't really Zacharin?
I got inducted into the Army. It was 1951, and the Korean War had started a year earlier. I passed the physical, even though I have a bad leg from polio. The Army said, oh, no, you're able. My mother almost had a heart attack. I had a buddy who was on Governor's Island doing recruiting posters. We went to school together. And he said, you know, he says, if you get drafted and if you don't get sent to Camp Gordon in Georgia, he said, if you get sent to Fort Dix, let me know. And I'm going to try and have you assigned over here. He was a sergeant at the time. There was an Air Force captain who was the art director, and he made a request for me and snatched me off a boat to go into Germany. And I went to Governor's Island and spent 18 months doing recruiting posters. So while I was there doing recruiting posters, I had a Class A pass whenever I was not on duty. I used to go up and see if I can get some comic work for weekends. I go in uniform. You know, a private in the Korean War, go in uniform into Stan's waiting room and said, I've been working for Stan for 18 months. He doesn't know me, but I've been doing the work that Lester Zacharin's been turning in. She comes out with a script and she said, Stan said, great, here's a story. It was a 4-page story, science fiction. And I said, well, when do you need the pencils? She said, well, you don't have to show us the pencils. Just ink it. We'll letter it in after you. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know how to ink except for that experience with the exhibit. But I was afraid to turn it down. It was money. So I took it. And the rest is history. I've been working for Stan, except for those 8 years at DC, for like 40 years, 35 years.
So how did you figure out about inking technique?
I got a crow quill pen. I knew enough because I had done illustration work, book illustration in school. Went to an art high school, did 3 years of illustration, book and magazine illustration. And I knew how to do pen work, but I didn't know how to do comic style pen work. So I just struggled along and I lucked out. It worked out okay. Very stiff, but you know, I did one of the best baby renderings I've ever done in my life on my first story. I don't know how the hell I had some good photo reference, I guess.
What was the story?
It was a science fiction story. It was about a couple who adopt a baby. The mother is found at the foot of the steps on the second day. The husband comes home. His wife is dead at the foot of the steps. And the only person in the apartment was the baby. And he didn't know who did this. Turns out the baby was an alien and killed the mother and then ends up killing the father. And the last panel is another couple is adopting him. It was one of Stan Lee's scientific gems, science fiction gems. It was called It.
It was funny that you didn't meet Stan that first time. He just had someone come out with
I met him when I brought in that first story. I had worked with Zacharin in a couple other companies. I worked for some minor companies. I also did a job for Famous Funnies. My first actual job was for Famous Funnies. I did a romance job, 15-page. He paid me for it, Stephen Douglas. Steve Douglas has a special place in heaven. He paid me $270 for that first job, and he never printed it. And I found out that he had a stack of artwork on his desk this high. It was all artwork he had given to beginners to give them a break. Never used it. I regret that I never went to his wake and tell his widow what a wonderful guy he was, because he probably supported half the young artists in the city.
It is tough to get that first job.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah. And so I had worked for other editors, and most editors were rather blasé. They would look at the stuff and grunt and give you a check or take an invoice and hope to get paid. Stan Lee was absolutely the different. After three or four editors I had worked for, some of them really annoying, some of them very negative, he was all advice and positive. He would give you, if you could do this, I like what you did here, do more of that, and you can't do enough of this, and full of life. And he was like 7 years older than me. I was 20 years old. He was 27. Amazing. I could see the difference between him and everybody else right away.
Do you think that he actually felt like he was living the story when he was doing it?
It's funny. He was like a lot of us. He was not really planning a life in comics. He had worked at 27. He was working about 10 years. No, he was working about 8 years in comics. I learned later. He started when he was about 18. When Jack Kirby got drafted and Joe Simon, he became the editor pro tem while they were in the Army. He was thinking of movies and novels. He was not, and all of us assumed that comics was on a short leash, that in a short time there would be no comics. We were all doing it temporarily, making money until it died. I swear to you, we all expected it, especially Stan. In fact, he was rooting for it. He was hoping it was going to happen because he was dying to do novels and plays and things. But he couldn't help his enthusiasm because for the same reason, I don't know whether he infected me with that or I had it already. I was a fanatic for making it good, meaning I wanted people to enjoy the stories. I was trying to make a buck, but I never did it the quickest way. I always slaved over it and made it as good as possible, on an ever-increasing level of quality. Even when I started, I never settled for my first drawing. I used to tear up pages. I used to erase pages. And Stanley was the same. And he may have added to my mania, not perfection, but ever-increasing quality, trying to make it so that people would forget they're looking at a drawing, that they're looking at this, something's happening on paper. I have to say, he inspired me that way.
So you worked through the 50s with him, didn't you?
Yeah, even while I was on Governor's Island, I was doing war stories and westerns. And then right after I got discharged in 53, yeah, I stayed, until 58, when the business hit the wall. From 49 to 58, I mostly worked for Stan Lee.
I don't have anything on Joe, and I really like his work.
Joe Manili? Stan Lee, I think either right after my first job, maybe that IT job, or the second or third, must have noticed that I was not the best inker. He called up Joe Manili, who had a studio in Flushing, Queens, and I lived on the city line about 15, 20 minutes away from there. So he told me, could you do me a favor? Could you go and spend a day with Joe Manili at his studio? So I get in my little 36 Plymouth, whatever it was, with the tar roof, and I drove in, and I spent the day there. I got there about 10, and I left about 4. And before, he was working on a double spread Western scene of an Indian attack on a fort. It was like Kirby-esque. You know, you could see all the wood, all the structure of the fort, the way wooden stockades were made. You could see the horse, the Indians on horseback, all authentic, all reeking of authenticity, full of dynamics. They're circling the fort. Guys are shooting long rifles in buckskin from the fort. I mean, typical boys' ranch kind of stuff. He's penciling that thing when I go there. He's talking to me a mile a minute, telling me how to structure a panel, how to work your figures in, how to make sure the background doesn't clash with it. He had this wonderful trick of doing his figures in a slightly bolder line than his backgrounds. And then when he did the ink work, he used a different pen for the backgrounds. He did a bolder pen for the foreground and a finer pen for the background, a great amount of depth, almost a 3D effect. He would do the whole thing in pen. After he blocked in the pencils very roughly, he would then rule up the page and start doing the inking immediately. And he would do a pen outline, contour drawing of everything on the page. And then he would do details. And then he would take a big brush, a number five brush or something, and start slashing blacks in there, which was also Kirby-esque. Joe Simon and Jack Kirby had worked out that principle. I could see it. They used a very thin brush or pen to do the outline of all their drawings. And then Jack and Joe, or just Jack, would go in there with the blacks and do all the technique. So it was a wonderful assembly line approach, but it also had this great effect of when you do a contour drawing and you're forced to make it simple because you don't want to have the background clash with it. It's the secret of simplicity in comics and of clarity. And Joe Manili had it nailed. He could do silhouettes, make you think you're looking at a character full of guns and knives and bristling with stuff. And the silhouette was as simple as can be. It was almost like a coloring book silhouette to some extent, only better. And then you would look at the finish and not believe all the stuff that's going on in the figure and in the background, but never once blending into each other, always clearly separated. And I immediately caught it. And he told me, he must have told me that that was the purpose. Because from that moment on, I understood the principle of clarity and depth in comics. And he did that double page spread while he's telling me all this stuff, knocking it out, mindlessly clear. It was just a pleasure to watch. One day, I never had to go back. I understood what Stan wanted from me from that day on.
And Joe did most of the covers for the Atlas books.
He was the most versatile, productive guy I ever ran into outside of Jack Kirby. Actually, Joe could even do more humor stuff. Kirby could do humor, but I think he always was an adventure and stronger characterization. But Manili could do, he could do Mickey Mouse to the Black Knight, fully rendered in Howard Pyle style. He was the most versatile, productive guy I ever saw in my life.
Could do everything. What was his background?
I don't know. And he died. I think he was 38 when he died. It was an unfortunate accident on a train.
Yeah, he fell off the back of the train.
Yeah, and there is no telling. I always tell people, if Joe Manili had not died at the age of 38, remember, I was 35 when I started Spider-Man. He was 38 when he died. He had his whole career ahead of him. Jack Kirby penciled until he was 70, 75 or 77. I'm still penciling a little bit, not too much, but the point is that he could have done so much for Stan during that boom time. I always kid around and say, if Manili had lived between Kirby and Manili, there wouldn't have been any work for the rest of us. Half of us would have starved.
So, Probably true. Did Stan ever talk about the fact that Manili, you know, about him dying so young?
Oh, he missed him terribly. He was so important to him.
Because I heard he was closer to Joe than he was to
Dan. He was very close to him. He was because Manili was an easygoing guy, as far as I know. I don't know how he was when he drank or anything like that. I didn't know him well enough. I just met him once. It was Captain America. I think I started in 54. And then when Captain America was dropped, I did Westerns, I believe. I started doing Westerns with the Western Kid for Stan until 58, when Martin Goodman had to close practically down to the bone. They only had two books. After about 50 titles or 40 titles, they just shut the doors, maybe Stan alone. And he had maybe Dick Ayers and Don Heck, the only two guys he was using at the time. And I went to D.C. and I did love stories. It's funny, when I first started for Stan, I went from $20 a page. And every time I went in, his enthusiasm was accompanied by generosity. He'd say, I love this. This is great. Call up a secretary. Give John Romita a $2 raise. Like every other month I would go, every other time I'd go in there, he would give me a raise. I went from $20 a page to $40 a page in like a year and a half, 2 years. And I was living on top of the world. I was getting top rate with Stan. And I was just still basically an amateur. And he loved it. And then things started to slump. In 54, the Congressional Committee, you know, Kefauver, Seduction of the Innocents, just destroyed our industry. The Senate Committee investigated comics and its influence on young people. And it was a nightmare. And Stan's business manager, accountant, whatever he was, Cotto, I think his name was Froelich, made a terrible impression on, you know, it just, he had no defense for anything we were doing. And frankly, there was no defense for the industry. It was crude stuff. It was terrible. My first horror story for Stan, the last panel was a decapitated head dripping with blood being held by some mean creature. So there was a lot of bad stuff being done, but we were not doing as bad as some people. EC Comics really took the brunt of it. So the whole comic industry almost folded, and DC was the only one that kept its head above water because they didn't do a lot of crap. And I went to DC. Preceding that, every time I went in for about a year and a half, I got a cut because things were getting bad for Stan. So I went from $44 a page down to $24 a page. Every time I got a cut, I would come home a little glum, and Virginia would say, well, how long are you going to take it? I say, well, maybe this is the last one. You know, I kept always kidding myself. I never liked to change companies. So at $24 a page, I was at my lowest ebb anyway. So when he dropped me, when he dropped the Western books, it was hardly a problem. I didn't know if I was going to get work, but I got work at DC for $38 a page. So it was like a nightmare. And then the sun came out the next day. It was amazing. And I did 8 years of love stories. I was making top rate in a matter of 6 months. I was their main cover artist for the romance department, and I was living great. And I thought, this is wonderful. I didn't think I would ever. I used to tell Virginia, if Stan Lee ever calls, tell him to go to hell. Because I figured I'm in the Cadillac of the industry now. DC was quality. I was proud to be there, even though I was on the fringes because I never got into the adventure department.
Is it the first time you ever worked for a woman editor?
Yeah. Zena Brody was there, and then she left soon after I went back. I had worked for her while I was still working for Stan. Another reason I was mad at him was that he told me, if you're going to work for DC, I won't be able to give you my primary stuff. So I dropped the DC stuff. 6 months later, he drops me. So I was really mad at him. Then there was another young lady that was very, very good to me, named Phyllis Reed. She was a writer, I guess. She was very accommodating and very patient, and we did a lot of good work together. We worked out cover situations that became storylines. They were basing their scripts on our cover situations. So I was really a cog in the wheel there for about 8 years.
Did you know Gene Colan was there? Because you guys did a lot of stories.
I didn't do it together, but at the same time. I met Colan, Seymour Barry, Bernie Sachs. These were the best in the business. I mean, Colan was an offbeat guy. He was not the standard DC slick. He was an illustrator in a comic book artist's skin. And I met Frank Giacoya. I met Mike Pepe. I never met Alex Toth, unfortunately, because I idolized Alex Toth. I was taking every Alex Toth book and devouring it with my brain. And I felt I was in heaven. I was making a decent buck, $45 a page. This was pencil and ink, by the way, which was not a lot of money, but I was making like $3.50 every 2 weeks. I was not making a lot of money, but it was more than I had been used to. So for those 8 years, I was very happy. And then suddenly the whole thing disappeared because one of the DC owners found a closet full of inventory and wondered why the hell we're paying for new artwork when we got all this. So they just shut down the romance department. And I was told, well, you're a freelancer. Go get work. They never shunted me into the adventure department. I was so hurt. But I was hurt, but I was almost relieved because I wanted to do Superman and Batman if I could, but I wasn't sure I was good enough. So I had mixed emotions. I was hoping they'd give me a chance, but they never did.
But the romance department was totally, I mean, in terms of...
It was on the same floor.
But the editors were totally different from in terms of who handled what book.
And also, editors were very flinty about overlapping. If you worked for one editor and you took a job from another editor, they would watch you like a hawk. If you turned in the other guy's book before his, he'd put a black mark on you. You'd be dead. They were very, very possessive, those guys. And I really feared those editors. They were known as a cutthroat bunch of editors. They had ego, and they were very quick to insult and to hurt. No diplomacy. I never dealt with Julie. I don't really know. But other guys I heard were really cold-blooded guys, and they would cut your throat.
Corporate, very corporate.
Yeah, and they were also competing with each other. There was not a cooperative effort there. They would not exchange artists easily. They would begrudgingly let a guy do somebody else's work.
I tend to think that it started earlier on when Whitney Ellsworth was the editor.
Oh, I thought it was because he had left.
Well, the point is, no one got credit, even when he went to Los Angeles. Well,
that I knew was their tradition.
He was still the editor. So everyone was fighting underneath him to try and get...
Noticed, yeah, yeah.
And recognition.
I know that the tradition was not to be giving credit.
Right.
And no, they said, they made you feel that if you put your name on, you were being not a team player.
Right. And apparently, I don't think anyone really got true credit until the early 60s. I
mean, maybe there were some guys. I remember Carmine started signing some things, Powell Smith and things like that.
No, I mean as an editor.
You're right.
Editor title.
Right. Even the artists were discouraged from putting their names in there. Right. I remember because I didn't put my name on covers. I thought it was not the professional thing to do. They had conned me, you know. Kaniger personified the DC personality to me. Kaniger wrote two of my series while I was doing romance stuff. It was a nurse series and a stewardess series. They were pretty well received, and I really put my best work into those. I worked for him for about a year and a half. I did the books together with him for about a year and a half. And we were going down in the elevator one day at the DC building, and he says, "The stuff looks good." I said, "Gee, I'm glad you like it." I said, I hope you don't mind that occasionally I do a little juggling." He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Sometimes I need a little transition panel between if people leave one building and enter another building, I put a little panel showing them walking on the street or something. And sometimes I split up. If you've got a big balloon in one panel, I will split it up and put one balloon one in there. If one panel has no balloon," I told him I did minor editing. Well, he almost ate me alive. He says, "Who the hell do you think you are changing my stuff?" I said, "I didn't change any words. You got no right to go adding panels and taking panels out." And a lot of times I combine two panels. I felt, oh my God, why did I tell him? You know, I was going to tell him, "You never noticed it. You just told me you love this stuff. And now you're jumping down my throat." Well, I thought I was finished. I went home that day figuring Phyllis Reed's going to call me up and say, "You're finished. You know, this is your last check. Turn in your work." He probably never told her that. And maybe he realized it made him look stupid or something. Whatever it was, I kept working until they ran out of inventory, until they got inventory built.
Did Kaniger have a temper?
Oh, he was explosive. Oh, he was. He personified the DC editor to me. And I never worked for him as an editor. I only worked for him because he was writing my stuff. I had an editor named Phyllis Reed who protected me. I saw him ream out artists in the bullpen, severely reamed them out. People that I respected. I just was grateful I never had to work for him because I had this mixed emotion about DC. I wanted to do the superheroes or some of the main titles. I would love to have done some of the war stuff except for tanks. I hated to draw tanks.
Do you think Kaniger did it for effect in terms of getting people to stand up and take notice of him?
I used to wonder about that. I had a feeling that almost all of those editors had the same behavior pattern. It was almost like how would a big shot editor act? And in other words, I don't think it was their natural bent. I think it was just they were putting on the mantle of an editor and acting the way a lot of people go into business and say, if you're a businessman, you got to be bloodthirsty. You can't be gentle. You can't be considerate. You got to come down heavy on people. Otherwise, they're not going to do anything. And I think they say, okay, if I'm going to be a boss, I'm going to be a mean boss. And I think that's what they did. I'm sure that if you're a creative person, you got to understand the other creative people and what makes them tick. You can't come down on them like that. Some of those editors, I don't think, were too creative. I don't want to name names, but I know Kaniger was a creative genius. And why he would come down on another creative person is very hard for me to understand. I always thought creative people should take care of each other.
He did. I don't know if he does anymore. I think he's better than a lot of other people.
Well, he was a boy wonder from what I hear. And I think he carried that that banner. He just felt that he really was justified. He really was one of the best. I mean, he created some of the best things in comics, and he carried them through and wrote some very touching stories at a time when very few people cared. You know, I admired him.
Do you think some of it ends up being bitterness that he wasn't recognized because he was in a business that doesn't get recognition?
Well, I think he did get, well, actually, he was well known among us, but I don't know if the public never got to know anybody. The public was under an impression that comics was done mechanically and nobody would take the time to do 120 drawings for a story that nobody's going to remember. I couldn't convince my own friends that I put that much work. Are you crazy? You're doing 120 different drawings, all these little figures and backgrounds and trees and 100,000 windows a month. And I could not get that. Young people used to write in and say that they were under the impression that comics was done mechanically. In other words, like a polarized photograph turned into line art. Some vague imaginative idea they had. It could not be somebody doing tedious work, doing the same heads over and over again in the same backgrounds.
Or drafting it out of their imagination.
Yeah, and making it out of their they couldn't comprehend that anybody would take the time to do it. It's a very tedious job.
Did you find it interesting that DC had all these various editors for all the books that they had, and that Marvel, on the other hand, was basically running out of one editor?
I didn't question it. I just assumed that DC was a powerhouse like General Motors, and that Marvel, or Timely at the time, was a one-man show, and that it sort of like grew on him. In other words, actually, when I went back there in 58, he only had 17 titles. So he was still building from 58 to 65. He had been building slowly. I just took it for granted that DC knows how to do it, and that Stan is just the guy who started a line of books and took in the work gradually, like grew it like it grew like Topsy, and he kept like the guy who lifts a cow every day, a calf every day, and when it's a cow, he still can lift it. That kind of stuff. You know, if you do it every day, you don't notice you're piling on the work. I never questioned it except to think it was a personality thing. And then when he started adding editors on, he still was very much involved in every concept. Frankly, I think he was an inspiration to a lot of people. He taught us how to make the stuff alive. There was no dead weight. We used to make fun of a lot of comics when we talk about plots. You see people with heavy-lidded eyes and closed mouths are screaming. The dialogue is screaming like you're standing on my foot and the face is passive, you know? And to this day, when I tell a young artist, all you people are sleeping, one of the first things I notice, you don't have anybody's mouth open, you don't have anybody's eyes intense. You need to get animation and dynamics into your work. And a lot of comic artists at the time, DC's best, used to do very passive stuff, very still stuff.
Do you find that romance helped you in terms of taking you through a range of emotions that you wouldn't have gotten in other parts of the business?
It was a very valuable thing. I think it was responsible for me to bring subtlety to my stuff and to add excitement when no excitement was happening. In other words, if I had a woman who's thinking about leaving somebody or is thinking about that her boyfriend just betrayed her, it's just a girl standing there with a sad look and a tear down her face. I would throw a bandana around her shoulders or her neck, flowing in the breeze, her hair flowing in the breeze. I used hair extensively as a dynamic, an element of dynamics. The wind was always blowing, the dresses were always blowing, and I never had anybody standing straight up and down if I could avoid it. I would bend them over. I would twist them. When they walked with full steps instead of mincing steps. The whole thing taught me how to make something out of nothing, how nothing is happening on a page. When you get a nothing page to this day, the artist's responsibility is subtle but very important. My son has learned that lesson almost from the beginning because I used to tell him about it. I used to say, this is a dead story. So I'm going to do this, this, and this while he's watching me. And he does it. He does it very well. He makes nothing pages interesting. And that is a hell of an accomplishment. Romance taught me that. I never got a chance to do that with Westerns or war or mystery stories.
Well, it is a totally visual.
Absolutely. The artist.
In terms of holding your attention to the page, because if that doesn't happen, you're never going to get to the story part of it.
And that's the reason that Stan's accidental procedure into art first and script second was a landmark milestone in the industry. I only worked 15 years as a freelancer before Stan in 65. There was a whole generation of guys working from 1935 on that had done comics from a script. The script narrowed your horizons and your range tremendously because they were pinned down to what they said in the page. If they had a lot of copy, you had a small amount of space. If you didn't have a lot of copy, you had to fill it with artwork. But you were stuck on the word. When Stan ran out of time and could not supply everybody with scripts, Jack Kirby would call him up and say, I got no script. He would give him a verbal quick thing, say, let me tell you, do the first five pages. The Fantastic Four is coming to Earth, crashing in one of their vehicles, and how they get out of it. They skim down a mountain like Indiana Jones did later and skipped and came across the water and broke their fall. And he would give Kirby just a five-page sequence to give him time to write the rest of the script. It turned out to be a 10-page sequence the next time. And then he'd be on the phone with me and saying, I don't have a script. When you come in, we'll talk about it. And so the verbal plot came about. And what happened is guys like Jack Kirby suddenly turned nothing stories into exciting visuals because he had to fill the space. A fight scene, if Stan would say, do a fight scene for four pages and I'll get the script to you for the rest of the story. So help me, it was an accident. Turned out to be the best idea in comics history because now it became the visual medium it should have been from the beginning. The written word should not have been, it's not a play. A stilted play in behind headlights. You've got action, you've got reaction. So to me, it was the greatest thing that ever happened. And I was terrified the first time he told me he was not going to give me a script. Not that I liked scripts. Scripts always bothered me. In retrospect, I realized I was already editing Bob Kaniger years before. So I was already a thinking artist, not aware that I was a thinking artist. I thought I was bringing beauty and authenticity and convincibility to it, but I never thought of it as bringing a new dynamic to it. When we started doing our own artwork before the words, then the other great thing happened. Stan suddenly found he didn't have to put all the balloons at the top of the panel, because now Jack Kirby would have all sorts of wonderful things going on. There's creatures crawling everywhere in every corner of the page. And Stan would then start and pick and choose where to put balloons on the artwork. That became an art form. If you look at Stan's original scripts, Xeroxes or photostats, whatever they made, Stan's placement of balloons was a work of art. Because not only was it less stilted than being all at the top of every panel, it also kept your eye moving across the page, something that scientists years later used in the Spidey Super Stories, which was done for young children to teach them to read. We did a Spider-Man series for 5 years with no advertising, scientifically designed to invite the kids to read and to follow a sequence. We couldn't put balloons everywhere. We could only put them in certain places scientifically located. Stan had done that instinctively. He had made it an art form. And young writers had to be indoctrinated into the art of balloon placements 5 years after he started.
Well, it also becomes a true collaborative meeting, because if you've got a plot, you get the visuals, you know, the artwork.
Yeah.
Then the writer looks at it and changes.
It sounds like the right thing to do from the beginning. It should have been done that way from the beginning, but it was never thought of because...
You've got the basic plot, but the dialogue completely changes.
And Stan said what happened was the things that he would have written with a blank page were one thing, but when he was presented with the art and expressions on people's faces and interesting characters that might have been overlooked, that Jack threw in. He used to tell me, if you put a character in the foreground, we call that a foreground element, a person standing on a street corner, maybe looking at a map, you know, or making a phone call on a phone booth. He used to say, don't make these damn people so interesting. He said, every time you do that, I want to write a story about them. So in other words, do the back of the head, do them shadow, but don't make them interesting because I like these characters. Stan found a whole new dimension in writing that he never realized before. He was free now to do dialogue he wouldn't have thought of because of the dynamics and the expression on the characters and the interplay of the characters, which might not have been in his mind. And he didn't have to explain, when the artist did a good transition job, so you could follow the sequence, he didn't have to make captions for it. If the artist failed to do a proper sequence, he could put a caption in to explain what's happening. So the whole thing opened up. It became a whole new industry. And I don't know why people don't make more of it. To me, it was like a discovery of the wheel. In the history of comics, it was a night, and I was terrified, frozen the first time. I said, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? But it forced you to do a visual. So he would say, make it interesting. When in doubt, make it interesting, make it exciting. And so then I was forced to now decide to myself. The guy walks in the room. He's looking around. Somebody's behind the door. He has to look back. I had to make up a sensible sequence of events, which made the whole story better, and then easier for Stan to write. And everything fell into place, but it was like pulling teeth. I was terrified.
Everything new is hard.
Other guy, Jack Kirby, thrived on it because he was a writer at heart. I was never a writer.
Did you guys think of yourself at the time as like a guerrilla force working against this big Goliath? Because Marvel obviously had a different way of working, had different personality at the top. Different people working for
him. And very casual approach.
Did you think of you guys?
You know,
us against them at all?
You want to hear something funny? I had both ends of the spectrum there, because while I was working for DC, they used to have discussions at the bullpen, the editors, and I was at one of those discussions. I think it was just one. And they were analyzing what the hell is happening. Why is Stan Lee getting such a market all of a sudden? They had Stan Lee's covers tacked up on a board, and some of DC's covers, and saying, ours are obviously better. Why are Stan Lee's books getting noticed? Why are people buying them? All they could glean from that, say, well, Stan's stuff looks crude. I mean, look at the jagged lettering and the crudity of the stuff, and how rough the stuff was. It wasn't that nice, clean, beautifully colored things that DC did. They were puzzled. One of them actually, I believe, suggested, I don't know who it was, I don't know if it was Sol Harrison, was, and saying perhaps there was something about the crudity of the stuff made youngsters feel more closer to the stuff that Stanley was doing than the slick stuff that was above the abilities of young people. In other words, that rock and roll thought where people said rock and roll became a success because every kid felt like I can get up and play the guitar like that. I could scream at the top of my lungs just like that. I could be a star. But if you're talking about Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby, every kid can't say I can sing like that. So that it became a user-friendly or a viewer-friendly thing, saying, wow, that's encouraging. I feel close to that. Whatever it was, they were missing the boat. Stan's formula was right out there in the open. It was make everything extreme action and extreme emotion. Nothing mild. Don't do anything mild. We used to joke. DC's reaction by every superhero was Great Scott, the mountains exploding. Great, you remember Great Scott? It was the key two words in the history of comics for 10 or 15 years. Everybody said Great Scott. Why? What the hell does Great Scott mean? And I don't think it was ever supposed to be double T. I think they meant the great a great Scott hero, a Scottish hero, because it couldn't be Great Scott because it wasn't Scott from the South Pole. It was, you know, I don't know what the hell they were talking about. Stan would say, holy moly, or whatever was the current expression. It's clobbering time. He would make up things, and immediately the kids responded to it. They started using those words. And whenever they wrote letters in, they would say, Stan, it's clobbering time. I'm going to destroy what you did in the Spider-Man book because I think you were wrong. And they would use all this, enough said. All of those things were tying him to his audience, and DC always was insulated from the audience. The audience always felt like an observer through a glass. And in Marvel, I think they felt like they were in the candy store with a chance to reach in and buy and get the candy. That's my guess.
Did it ever occur to anyone in bullpen sessions that it might be the content that was making them come to the book?
I'm telling you, it was an open secret. Any editor worth his salt should have said, I see what Stan is doing. He's pulling the kids in as a friend instead of an insulated reader. And then I went over to Stan during the same period. So I saw both ends of it. And Stan was chuckling. He was saying, we're not hiding anything. In fact, he was telling people in the bullpen bulletin what he was doing. He was saying, Jack Kirby and I got together over lunch and we discussed the plot and it's going to be dynamite and we got plenty of action for you. You guys are going to love it. They weren't doing that at DC. And they were like searching around for an answer when it was told to them every day in Stan's letters.
Probably was even tougher for them to understand because they controlled distribution. I mean, Marvel books were hard to find.
In fact, DC was distributing them during that time because Marvel had screwed himself with their own distribution that failed or something. Yeah, there was some business. It was very funny because we were succeeding despite every possible impediment in our way. And there was also a terrible distribution system, period, in the business. Kids used to come to me in my house in Western Nassau County and tell me that they couldn't find the comics. Where can we go to get comics? And I used to go around to local stores and ask, and they'd say the distributor sometimes gives us books, sometimes they don't. A lot of times they left them in the back of the truck because they didn't want to bother taking returns the next week. A lot of times store owners never opened up the bundles. They just returned them. I don't know how anybody made a success. We had a success despite every single roadblock that people could give us. The economy was wrong. Everything was wrong. People couldn't get books. And we had a success.
Do you think culturally, because of the 60s and the way things were and the upheavals that were going on campus, that all of that stuff contributed to the success?
Well, Stan used it. He reflected the daily life. I don't think DC reflected the daily life until after Stan started. I think Julie Schwartz and Carmine rightfully take credit for the rebirth of superheroes in a certain sense. But I think the boom of comics in the early 60s was Stan's doing completely. They did their share. They glamorized and renewed old characters into new characters and made them dynamic and wonderful. But I think Stan is the guy responsible, because I think he turned the nature of the medium into an open-ended possibility. He opened up the possibilities. They were no longer that parochial, narrow group that they were reaching for. They suddenly reached college students, college professors. We used to get letters from faculty. We got letters from fan clubs in the service that used to get around and compare books and talk about them. The famous stories of movie producers and directors that commented and contacted Stan and told him what they thought of the stuff and even visited him in his office. Fellini and Alain René, great filmmakers, were all fans of Stan's. DC never had that kind of reaction. They had a wonderful clientele like me. I used to read their books. I would kill to see Johnny Thunder by Alex Toth, you know, and Carmine. Loved Carmine stuff. The thing is that they missed the boat. The answer was on the wall, and they never read it.
I think they generally figured that their audience was 10 to 14 years old.
And they didn't want to disturb that. You know, the old publishers were very, very narrow-minded. Martin Goodman held us back for many years because he refused to kick over the traditional stuff. We did a successful book in magazine form, the Spidey Spectacular, in black and white, and he canceled it before he found out the final figures. It sold 58% at a 35% price. He could have made a killing. He would have beaten everybody to the black and white magazine business. The second issue of that series, Spidey Spectacular, was a full-color comic book. To get it back to normal, he said, because his buddies, meaning the printers and the engravers and the distributors, told him, Martin, why do you want to mess around with an oversized magazine? It can't fit in the racks. The hell with it. Go back to regular comics. Do your regular stuff. And I guarantee you, he held us back for like at least 5 years, our own publisher. And I don't think the DC publishers were above holding their editorial staff back from progressing. They were very, very conservative and narrow-minded.
I was going to say, Jack Leibowitz and Martin Goodman were friends.
The story is that they would talk over golf, and Leibowitz would tell Martin Goodman that the Justice League is selling like hotcakes. Next thing you know, Stan Lee is told to come up with a group. It's called the Fantastic Four. That's supposed to be history. And I wouldn't be surprised, because they were a very strange bunch of guys. They were mired in the 30s, and here it was the 50s, and things were slipping through their fingers, and they didn't care. Martin Goodman said, what do I need to expand? I'm making plenty of money now. He was making plenty of money. The rest of us weren't. Stan Lee was hungry for more, you know. It was a very strange time.
What's the one thing out of the comic book business that you've gotten that has enriched your life?
You know, it's funny. I never looked for enrichment. I realize in retrospect that that was a lacking in my generation. We were only in it to make a buck. I envy the generation that came in the 90s, in the late 80s and the 90s. I will say that the generation that came in the 70s was a disappointment to me. I don't want to name names, but those guys got into comics and then left comics to go into posters and advertising and whatever else, illustration. I can't fault them for trying to make themselves better, but they failed us, because the generation we expected to fill the gap in the 70s never showed up. So we jumped to the late 80s and 90s, and there's a whole group of foreign artists, local artists, college graduate artists, the Walt Simonson type, the Todd McFarlane approach, the Liefeld kind of guy. They come into comics nowhere near with the approach we had. We had only, let's make a buck, and when the comic industry dies, we'll all throw a party and go into something else. I swear, I never had a feeling that I needed gratification. But I will tell you, before I finish, I'll tell you what I did find out later. But these guys, I envy them, because they came in with a mission. They came in with a mission to do comics. They wanted to do comics. They wanted to stay in comics as opposed to us. And they were dedicated to making comics better. Whether they succeeded or failed is another question. But they cared about comics more than we ever did. We all had the John Buscema approach on comics. It's crap, you know. What are we? We're only doing it for a buck, and when we're out of it, we're happier, you know. That kind of stuff. Sometimes that's overstated and a curmudgeon kind of joke, but I do envy them because, and I respect those guys, even though I don't always like their work. I respect the guys because they cared about making comics better and better and better. And they succeeded in changing comics. I don't know if it was good or bad. I'll leave that to history. But I will tell you what happened to me. I always felt frustrated. When I was 35 to 40, I felt like a failure. I felt like, what am I doing? I'm doing the same stuff over and over again. Why don't I get out? I wanted to go into advertising and do storyboards. I didn't know if that was the answer. I thought I'd make more money, whatever. But I found Virginia kept telling me not to be despondent. You know, she kept saying, what are you worried about? You're doing good stuff. I suddenly woke up one day and realized, what am I complaining about? I'm getting steady work. And I am telling stories that I'm getting responses to from people. People are telling me they love my stories. And I suddenly realized, why do I have to become a magazine illustrator or a painter to get satisfaction? I'm getting satisfaction doing what I'm doing. It was like, again, as you said, like a light went on. And I said, I will do the best comics I can, and I'm going to enjoy it and not worry about where I'm going to go next. But it was too late at the dance to make a difference in my life that much. I just had a little bit less anxiety and a little bit more satisfaction. I was reeling. I'm doing the best comics I can do, and people are appreciating it. What the hell am I complaining about? So I got satisfaction much later than I expected.